Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and once again it is my pleasure to be joined by Ed Haslam, the author of Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory published in softcover by the Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995. Ed, in the first half-hour segment, we've been talking about the city of New Orleans as a political entity, Tulane University as a political entity, both of them as national security entities, their heritage not only being entwined but inextricably linked with American commercial, political, and national security connections to Latin America. One of the foremost names in the history, recent history of New Orleans and Tulane University and the medical community in New Orleans is Dr. Alton Ochsner, whom we have been speaking about. We've been speaking about his involvement with the American Cancer Society, on whose board William Wild Bill Donovan, the head of the OSS in World War II, sat. And Alton Ochsner, in addition to being a prime mover in the American medical community, was also an extremely well-connected political animal. And like New Orleans and like Tulane University, many of his most important connections through the Ochsner Clinic and Tulane Medical School went to Latin America. Could you tell us about those?
Sure, and well-connected is the term. I know of no one who's better connected than Alton Ochsner. For example, I mean, the biggest political name in all of Latin America is probably Juan Perón. He was one of Alton Ochsner's patients. Ochsner went down to Buenos Aires to take care of him personally. Another famous name in Latin America is Anastasio Somoza, the notorious dictator of Nicaragua who was thrown out by the Sandinistas. Ochsner was his personal physician in the United States and worked with Henri de Baye, who was his personal physician when he was down in Nicaragua. De Baye, by the way, winds up being on the board of directors of Guy Bannister's and the Communist League of the Caribbean later on.
That, by the way, is an important connection. We're going to be developing some of the political connections to the milieu of the Kennedy assassination of the intelligence community later on in this interview. But I want to underscore that as well as some of the other intelligence and national security connections that we've touched on in the interview to date. Go ahead, Ed.
Shortly after World War II, just to give you another illustration, the dictator of Panama was near death. His name was Duque, Thomas Duque. The United States government was indebted to Duque for fighting off Nazi aggression in his country and wished to help save his life. They called Alton Ochsner to go down and take care of Duque, which he did, and Duque survived. But to have someone who is Franklin Roosevelt, President Roosevelt's Secretary of State during World War II, to pick up the telephone and call Alton Ochsner personally to ask him to go take care of a foreign head of state, let you know that this guy is a national player and he is connected more than most people ever even thought about. When Richard Nixon comes to New Orleans in the early 1960s after losing his gubernatorial bid in California, who does he have lunch with? He has lunch with Alton Ochsner. When Alton Ochsner's wife wants to go to take a honeymoon in the Greek Isles and she can't get her passport renewed, what does she do? She calls the White House and asks to speak to Dick, because her first husband was involved in launching Nixon's political career. So there's a lot of powerful national contacts here in the United States for Ochsner. There are a powerful international contacts. In fact, the list of countries that he got awards from stretches from Greece to Japan. Of course, it's every place in Latin America. He also personally took care of Clint Murchison, the Texas billionaire.
Before we get to Ochsner's connections to Clint Murchison, and with people like Clint Murchison, Richard Nixon, and others we're going to talk about, we are moving in the direction of the political milieu surrounding President Kennedy's assassination. You discuss some hypothetical connections between the very influential and national security-connected Louisiana congressional and senatorial delegations and the Ochsner Clinic and funding that may have come from the Hill-Burton Fund and conceivably the CIA. Could you tell us about that?
Well, one of the interesting testimonies before Congress was when they had Admiral Stansfield Turner come testify about the CIA's domestic medical operations, and the Senate asked Admiral Turner how did the CIA organize this, and how did they pay for it, and how did they launder the money for it? And Turner said that there were 159 incidences where the CIA had arranged to build hospitals for people, and they would have a third party put up the seed money, and then they would facilitate getting what was called a Hill-Burton grant, which was a normally non-secret program where Congress would help a community build a hospital to pay for the other 90% of the hospital. And in return, the CIA got access to one-sixth of the bed space of the hospital. So if they had people that got injured or shot or anything else outside the country, they got a place to bring them back and take care of them. And they also had a place to offer medical services to special people outside the United States who they wanted to favorably influence. So the Ochsner Clinic and Hospital, they're the same thing nowadays, more or less. They're all in the same location, on the same campus, was built with a Hill-Burton grant from the United States Congress, and it also received a $750,000 contribution from Clint Murchison.
Clint Murchison, the independent Texas oil operator, is an individual who, along with the closely related Hunt family, not biologically but politically and economically related Hunt families, are names that surround and entwine, run all through the milieu surrounding the events of President Kennedy's assassination. Could you tell us that there's the possibility, as I recall, of some Murchison funding having been channeled to Ochsner's operations?
Well, it's been suggested. First of all, it is stated in Ochsner's biography that Murchison donated $750,000. He's not the only one who donated money to Ochsner. Ochsner was a consummate fundraiser. In fact, the Stearns, who were part of the Sears fortune, who also owned the TV stations and the radio stations that wind up being part of the Lee Harvey Oswald legacy, also donated money to the Ochsner Foundation, as well as some wealthy industrialists who lived in the South. So, but Murchison, the connection between Murchison and Ochsner is very clear. Murchison even gave Ochsner a Cadillac as a present for taking care of him, and invited him on numerous personal trips and hunting trips where they went down to Mexico and hunted all over Texas and stuff. So there was a very real relationship between Ochsner and Murchison.
You mentioned, too, that Ochsner held a very sensitive position working for the United States government.
Actually, he held a couple of them. And one of the most interesting things is to look at the FBI file on Alton Ochsner, because the clearances for him came off of J. Edgar Hoover's desk. And so when you look at how connected this guy is, one of the connections you have to understand was that J. Edgar Hoover was keeping an eye on Alton Ochsner on a regular basis and was clearing him for, quote, sensitive positions for the United States government. The years of these sensitive positions, I think, are very interesting. One is in 1957, and the other is in 1959. And we will be discussing in the next part of the interview some of the discoveries that happened in relationship to cancer-causing viruses. And those are the two big years, in 1957 and 1959. Actually, in 57, it looks like he's working for the FBI. I'm not really sure. The document's a little ambiguous, but it's off of Hoover's desk, and he's being cleared for it. And then in 1959, his relationship with the FBI is terminated for one reason or another, but it's probably just to free him up to continue his next assignment, because he's obviously being cleared for another assignment, and they don't even say what the agency was.
You mentioned that a graduate student, I believe it was at Tulane, alleged that Ochsner. Are there two pronunciations of that? I had always been pronouncing it Ochsner.
Well, you're pronouncing it the way that they say is correct. But I grew up in New Orleans, and I grew up saying Ochsner instead of Ochsner, and it I have to say it the way I'm comfortable with. I think there are two pronunciations. If you went to New Orleans and asked 100 people, you'd probably hear 50 each way.
All righty. Well, I'll say Ochsner and you say Ochsner. We'll have it covered between the two of us.
There we go.
All righty. You mentioned that a fellow graduate student, I believe it was, asserted that Ochsner was part of an international fascist group in touch with Nazi elements and fugitive Nazi scientists in Latin America.
Yes, he did, and he was a Latin American from the southern, from South America. And one of the things that is most noticeable about Ochsner's history was that he went to Switzerland for several years and Germany, and he worked in a medical environment over there speaking German. So by the 1940s, when this issue arose, Operation Paperclip and the repatriation of Nazi scientists out of Germany at the end of the war, Ochsner was sitting there being a prominent medical person who spoke fluent medical German, and that made him a resource, if nothing else. It is not known exactly what his relationship was or if he was used to debrief people who came over or whatever. But in 1946, he was given a award or citation by the Department of Defense for his medical research contributions to the United States government. So the man certainly has a reputation in Latin America as being affiliated with a lot of those people. What the real truth is behind all that, I'm not in a position to say.
Yeah, I mentioned that because there are some connections between the Kennedy assassination milieu, including a person we're going to be talking about later, Guy Bannister, the head of the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean, part of what eventually became the World Anti-Communist League, that does overlap the post-World War II Nazi underground milieu. Talking about some of the reactionary political connections of Alton Ochsner, you mentioned his close connections with Richard Nixon, an individual who was a very close political ally and backer of Richard Nixon. William Frawley was also very close to Ochsner.
Well, Frawley was not only close to Ochsner, but Frawley was the major financial contributor to Ochsner's political propaganda mill, which was called the Information Council for the Americas. And in the 1960s, when Garrison started investigating the assassination of Kennedy, it became apparent that he was going to start moving in the direction of INCA and the people associated with it. And at that point in time, the executive director of INCA, who was Ed Butler, and we'll talk about him more in detail in a little bit, and all of the files of INCA were put on an airplane and sent to California, where Butler was given a job working for Frawley. Frawley was also very close to Reagan and those people out there, and it should be noted that Reagan, of course, refused all the extradition requests which were presented to him by Garrison.
Ed Butler is a person we're going to talk about in connection with Lee Harvey Oswald and the famous WDSU interview that was played all over the United States. The painting of Oswald Red is something we're going to talk to in a second. By way of further developing the political foundation of some of the elements we're talking about, we might also note that William Frawley was also very closely connected to the American Security Council, a right-wing intelligence outfit composed initially largely of former FBI agents, and an outfit that used as its documentary seedbed, I guess one could say, the files of Harry Young's American Vigilance Intelligence Federation. Young was a raving Chicago-based anti-Semite who was actually formally part of the Hitler Goebbels anti-Comintern in 1939-40. So again, some of the political heritage linking some of the people we're talking about and the forces of international fascism are there, although in some cases not necessarily direct or perhaps even particularly relevant. Information Council of the Americas, an apparent intelligence front, Ochsner's outfit, was very much involved with Lee Harvey Oswald, and Ed Butler was very much involved with Lee Harvey Oswald. Could you tell us a little about Oswald, INCA, Ed Butler, Ochsner, and how they came to be significant with regard to the history of Kennedy's assassination?
Sure. Let's start with what is INCA. INCA was, and again, that's the Information Council for the Americas. I'll just call it INCA from this point forward. It was set up to be a propaganda, an anti-communist propaganda machine aimed at Latin America. And what they did primarily was they interviewed Cuban exiles and American political leaders and made radio tapes, and then they distributed those radio tapes to 123 radio stations in Latin America. That was their overt-approved reason for being. I'm not sure if any of those 123 radio stations ever played any of them, and that didn't matter. But the point was, Inca's mission was to get the word out about communism and discuss how Castro took over Cuba, and so that the rest of Latin America could defend themselves against communism. Or so the story went.
Well, many listeners on some of the stations that will be hearing this interview have heard the Ed Butler, Lee Harvey Oswald, Carlos Bringuier, WDSU interview. Inca also appears to have had some very strong connections to the U.S. intelligence apparatus. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the strongest one that one can see in the paper trail is that on Inca had a director of security for some reason, God only knows why. But this man's name was Robert Reinold, and he was the former president of the American Society of Former Special Agents of the FBI, which basically gave him access to the whole FBI community, retired community. There are a lot of speculations about other relationships between Inca and the American intelligence community that I'm not really prepared to get into in detail here because I don't have smoky pistol proof on it, though I've heard about it my entire life. What I'd really like to address is this issue of Lee Harvey Oswald and Inca,
right?
Because I think this is a critical point here.
Before we get to Oswald, I would note that Anthony Summers and Dick Russell, Anthony Summers in his book Conspiracy and Dick Russell in his 1992 book, The Man Who Knew Too Much, discuss Ed Butler as being viewed as an asset by CIA and willing to do favors, as well as, or I should say an alleged asset, as well as the possibility of some connections between military intelligence and Ed Butler.
And all that is true, and Butler wrote letters to the CIA shortly before the Kennedy assassination offering their services and stuff, though the CIA officially turned them down on all that stuff. So there's a lot of stuff with, and Summers is correct in all that stuff. It's just not an area that I have personal information on.
We should note that certainly Ed Butler had some connections with Lee Harvey Oswald through Inca in New Orleans, and those not only came to light, but came to be quite well publicized.
The most important thing that happened to Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans was they got him on a radio debate and produced a newspaper clipping from 6 years earlier about his, quote, defection to the Soviet Union, which was not really defection, but that's the way it was reported in the newspaper. So they had this opportunity to, live on the air, present Lee Harvey Oswald with an article from the Washington Post which said he had defected to the Soviet Union and renounced his citizenship. And that pretty much buried him with the public as it related to the charges that he shot President Kennedy. Now, how did all that occur? Let's press rewind sort of for a minute and take a look at the actions here. On August 9th, there was an incident on the street, which is referred to as a street fight. It was sort of a shoving match. It looks like a theatrically produced event, and it didn't happen until the TV cameras were out. Now, the TV camera, this happened right in front of the International Trade Mart that Clay Shaw was affiliated with earlier.
We're going to come back to Clay Shaw in a
minute. But the TV cameras belonged to WDSU television. And when Oswald was put on the radio, he was put on WDSU radio. And both of those stations are owned by the same person. And that's Edgar Stern. Stern was a core member of Inca and was one of its largest financial contributors.
And also very closely connected to Ochsner.
And he was a major financial contributor to Ochsner. Well, Ochsner was president of Inca. And to have Ochsner being president of Inca and Inca's really only employee, Butler, being the guy that debates Oswald, and to have the Inca member Stern send out the TV cameras and provide the radio station for the debate all meant that there was a lot of close contact between Oswald and this Inca group.
Now, as part of the New Orleans elite, Oxner was also certainly very familiar with and involved in some organizations with Clay Shaw, who, after the death of David Ferry, whom we will speak about in a few minutes, was the main focus of Jim Garrison's investigation. Can you tell us a little bit about Oxner and Clay Shaw?
Sure. Shaw was the general manager of International Trademark, who, and at one time was the president of International House, and sat on the board of directors of an organization called the Foreign Policy Association, which brought, amongst other people, CIA General Cobble, the brother of the mayor of Dallas, to New Orleans to make a presentation. Alton Ochsner was also president of International House. He was very active in all the international trade circles there in New Orleans, and was on this foreign policy committee with Clay Shaw, none of which is particularly suspicious in its own right, but it certainly points out that there was a lot of contact. In fact, I even saw a nice photograph in the New Orleans Library of Ochsner and Shaw deliberately set up in their office to have a picture, a publicity picture, released together.
Yeah, not that all of these connections are necessarily conspiratorial, but rather as we develop the scenario that envelops the events in your book, talking about New Orleans as a political entity, Tulane University as a political entity, Alton Ochsner as a political entity, it's interesting to see the growth and intertwining of many of these same people, many of these same institutions, and how they really came to form the foundation of the events that we're discussing. Oswald in New Orleans was also very much involved with a building that also housed the detective agency of Guy Bannister. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, first of all, it is reported by numerous witnesses that Oswald and Bannister were seen together, and Oswald was seen in Bannister's area. Bannister, just for a reminder for everyone, was a former FBI agent, but he was not just a run-of-the-mill FBI agent. He was a special agent in charge, meaning like the general manager of the field office, in Chicago, which is not an irrelevant place. And he retired from there and came down to New Orleans. So Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, I mean, they're the biggest cities in America. These people were in daily, regular contact with J. Edgar Hoover throughout their tenure as special agents in charge. So Bannister comes down to New Orleans, sets up shop in 544 Camp Street, and when Oswald shows up, Oswald's operating out of Bannister's place or is spying on Bannister. Nobody knows exactly what Oswald was doing, but he was in Bannister's place on a regular basis. David Ferry was also in Bannister's place on a regular basis. The Clinton incident, which is one of the most interesting things that relates to this collection of people with Clay Shaw and Ochsner and Bannister, et cetera, is something we should really emphasize. The backbone of Jim Garrison's case against Clay Shaw was that he was affiliated with Lee Harvey Oswald during the summer of 1963, prior to the election, prior to the assassination. And the key event in that was this incident over in Clinton, Louisiana, where Clay Shaw and David Ferry drove Lee Harvey Oswald over there, and Oswald tried to register to vote. This was an unusual day because they were having the Congress for Racial Equality was having a black voter registration drive, and Oswald was the only white person in line, and therefore he was sort of memorable to the organization. But if you can think about a sun-bleached Louisiana small town having a black voter registration day, all the white people in town were standing around the middle of town watching the blacks register to vote, which made Oswald very conspicuous, and also made the sheriff in the town very suspicious about this black Cadillac that drove into town that Oswald got out of. So this man went over, the town sheriff went over and asked the driver of the car to identify himself. The man said his name was Clay Shaw of the International Trademark and produced the driver's license that matched. Now, this information was told to the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1979, but instead of releasing it to the press, they had this town marshal in Clinton, Louisiana, tell them this in executive session, and they stamped it secret and kept it from the public for 16 years. And what this testimony proves is that Garrison's essential claim about the connection between Clay Shaw and Lee Harvey Oswald was correct.
And we should also note that a Bannister investigator named David Ferry, whom we will speak at great length about later on in this interview, was also apparently in that car, and a very distinctive individual he was.
And he was a very close friend of Lee Harvey Oswald from earlier days when Oswald was a cadet in his Civil Air Patrol unit, and there are numerous witnesses that saw them together.
We're going to get back. Excuse me for interrupting, Ed. We're going to get back to that later on. We're almost at the end of this half hour. David Ferry was a very distinctive individual. Perhaps as the last item on this part of the interview, you might want to just tell us about why he was so readily identifiable in that car in Clinton, Louisiana.
Well, Ferry was a bizarre-looking character. He had lost all the hair on his body and replaced the hair on his head with an orange wig that was scotch taped or glued, depending on his mood, to his head, and he grease painted on eyebrows because his eyebrows had fallen out, and therefore he looked rather ridiculous, and he wore sort of Salvation Army type clothes, and anybody who saw Ferry always remembered him. The real key thing about Alton Ochsner, who we started out this section talking about, and Bannister, is that after Bannister's death, all of his files that he maintained, his intelligence files that he shared with the FBI, disappeared from his office.
We're going to talk about how you came across that. I would simply note, in connection with civil rights activities, that Bannister also published a thing called the Louisiana Intelligence Digest, which was a racist newsletter that blamed the American civil rights movement on a communist conspiracy. We have been speaking with Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory, soft cover edition, Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995. We are going to continue this interview with Ed Haslam in our next half-hour segment. For Ed Haslam, this is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.